2407. And we have legislative counsel here. Mr. Vallampard, would you please come up? Colleagues, I had, just for your information, I had, oh, where'd Senator Walker go?
Right here.
Behind
you. Oh, okay. I had dash 10 amendments put together to reflect our discussion after the last meeting, so I invited Mr. Hendricks here to explain what those do.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. The dash B10 amendments that you should have in front of you are a gut and stuff of the B and Gross bill that came over from the House. Under the amendments, there will be a change in the manner in which you determine the benefit of legislative members of the Legislative Assembly under PERS. The main thrust of the bill will be to give them basically the same calculating factor as applicable to general service members, 1.67, instead of the 2% factor that's currently in the law. And that factor comes into play in calculating the benefit, because the full formula benefit for PERS members is years of service multiplied times final average salary times a factor. And with the 2% factor, the principle was that after 30 years of service, you get 60% of your final average salary. With the 1.67, you get 50% of your final salary after a 30-year career. Section 2, starting on page 3, is important because it's the applicability provision. What Section 2 says is that these changes, the change with respect to the change in the factor, are basically applicable for terms of service by members of the Legislative Assembly that commence on or after the effective date of the Act, which means basically people who are appointed or elected on or after the effective date. So this does not affect the calculation for service during the current term of office of any member, but when they're reelected, at that point, all service thereafter would be calculated under the 1.67 factor. And then there's a grandfathering clause for members who have some period of term of office. They have to be members who, A, are serving in the Legislative Assembly on the effective date of the Act, and B, they have to be persons who have some period of service as a legislator before January 1st, 1995, which means you're primarily talking about people who had some service by reason of being elected in 1992 or previously. And those people will continue to have the 2% calculator for all subsequent terms of service. And that's what the amendments do. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Just a brief announcement. If there's anybody here for Senate Bill 763, it won't be heard today. Questions of Mr. Hendricks? Do you folks understand what the amendments do?
Yes.
Senator Walker?
I think I do. It took me a moment to sort of collect my thoughts and myself. But this is not it applies only to people elected after 2003, after this act takes effect?
Senator Corcoran, Chair Corcoran, Senator Walker, it applies to terms of service that commence on or after the effective date of the act, whether by reason of election or appointment. So okay. It doesn't affect the calculation for service performed before the next term of office commenced and for.
Okay, so as an example, I was elected in 1998, so the old rate that we have now will apply up until this bill passes, and then the new rate applies.
When you commence a new term of office.
Oh, so until this I'm on a four-year term now, so this completes, once that four-year term is completed.
That's correct.
And I run again, and I'm reelected, hopefully. then it changes over to the new rate.
That is correct.
I gotcha.
And to some degree, that's to try to allay concerns about contract rights, about changing midterm.
Okay.
The theory being that each term's a new contract and that you can change it for future terms of service.
Okay.
That's all we need is another PERS lawsuit, right, David? Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could ask one more question.
Yes, Senator.
Mr. Hendricks, you also explained how this percentage is based on your salary, and current legislative salary is $1,283 a month. So it's not a whole heck of a lot of money we're building up in a retirement fund, even at the rate it is currently, and so it's not that big of a savings. But
Chair Walker, Senator Walker, that is correct. Really, the only members to whom it makes really a serious difference probably are those who have public employment whose normal job outside of the legislature is in public employment. It will affect those folks because that factor does count against their salary as other than a legislator, and so it was a difference for them between the 1.67 and the 2.0.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, that got a bigger answer than I expected. Thank you.
Thank you, David. So can we amend this bill with the dash 10s?
We're in work session.
Senator Menace, yes, we are.
Move the B-10 amendments to 24.
Senator Menace moves the B-10 amendments to 2407. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, we call the roll, please.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menace?
Aye.
Chair Clark?
Aye. It's 2407 is amended with the B-10s.
Sure.
Senator?
With your consent, I move House Bill 2407 as amended on the floor of the Senate, the DuPass recommendation.
Senator Menace moves House Bill 2407 as amended to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, call the roll, please, Ms. Gravel.
Senator Stein?
Aye.
Senator
Bell?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Clark? Aye. And we will send that to the floor, and I guess I'll carry it. Unless you two still have your competition going.
I lost.
He's conceited.
He's conceited. I don't think he is. He seems like a nice fellow. Oh, conceited. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh. Okay. We will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2237. Would you tell us what that does, Mark?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 2237 prohibits the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training and the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training from disclosing a photograph of a public safety officer without the written consent of the officer or the officer's employer. It requires the board or department to notify an officer and the officer's employer if either has received a request for the photograph. It requires a public safety agency to provide the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training with access to the personal records of an employee or former employee of the public safety agency if the department A requests records, B is conducting an investigation relating to the employee, and C the information is relevant to the issues being investigated. This measure grants immunity from civil liability to a public safety agency that discloses information so long as the agency acts in good faith and allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to investigate, take action against, or revise or void an action against a public safety officer, even if the officer's certification has lapsed or been suspended or revoked. We have two amendments.
Okay.
Dash ones that we're considering is a minor change that removes a provision requiring notification of an officer if a request has been made for a photograph. Current law already requires that an employer disclose requests and this removes a redundancy while retaining the ability to keep criminal investigations confidential. We also have a dash 4 amendment, which in essence is combining of this measure with Senate Bill 271 that we have considered previously in the committee.
Thank you very much. We have Scott Tye and Mark Landauer. Scott from the Department of Public Safety, Mark from City of Portland. Why don't you both come up? Is anybody else wanting to testify on this bill? Okay. Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Senator Corcoran.
Go ahead.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Tye, and I'm the Standards and Certification Division Director for DPSST. I've submitted written testimony, and Mr. Ellsworth has done an excellent job of describing the bill and pretty much mirrors my testimony. So, really, I don't have anything to add but to be here to answer any questions that you may have regarding the bill. Basically, we have three key elements that we're trying to accomplish here, and that's to keep the photographs of public safety officers we have on file confidential, and we would not want to release those unless we get written permission from the agency or the officer themselves. We're asking for access to personnel records, and it would be limited to the investigations that we may be conducting. And finally, we would thirdly like to clarify our authority to continue an investigation if it goes beyond 90 days. We've also communicated with my colleague on my left here, and we agree and support the concept of the dash 2 amendments. With that, we'll answer any questions.
Dash 4 amendments.
Oh, dash 4? I'm sorry.
Okay. And who was the author of the dash 1 amendments? Do we know? What?
The agency.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions of Scott? Go ahead, Mark.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations. The A4 amendments, as Mr. Ellsworth indicated, is essentially a compilation of Senate Bill 271, which was heard by the committee in late February. Essentially, the amendment will do four things. It will allow DPSST to continue to accredit local basic training, police training programs until either the police policy committee certifies to the governor that the new facility is completed, or until January 1 of 2007, whichever one is soonest. It would grandfather any accreditation programs during that time that were in action when the accreditation ability of DPSST ceases. It will also permit DPSST to accredit what is called the Oregon Police Corps. And finally, Section 8 of the amendment will codify into statute that DPSST may continue to accredit advanced leadership and continuing training courses and programs for law enforcement personnel. Be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Colleagues, I think what I would like to do is move the... Do we need both the dash ones and the dash fours, or do we just need the dash fours? We need them both? Okay. So my intention would be to move these two amendments into the bill today, and then we are awaiting the results of the existence of some other bills in the other chamber. So we will, this has a beautiful relating clause. So with that, Senator Menace, do I hear a motion?
Move the adoption of the A4 amendment to House Bill 2237.
The A4 amendments move
the A1 also.
A1 as well.
Sure.
Can we do them both in one motion? Move the A1s and the A4s into the bill. Any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Menace moves House Bill 20. Oh, no, that's all we're doing. Yeah, we're done then. All right, we'll close the work session. Good. Thank you. All right. Now, we're done there. Now we're going to do House Bill 3120A, a public hearing and possible work session. Mark, would you please tell us what that does?
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, we have before us House Bill 3120. And this measure requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to appoint a 10-member advisory committee to develop criteria for streamlining agency rules. It specifies the duties of the committee and directs agencies to request public comment on proposed rules. This measure sunsets on December 31, 2004, and is effective upon passage. We have two sets of amendments to this measure, the dash 4, which changes the period of time an agency has to consider a petition from 30 to 90 days, and it narrows the scope of petitions to filings that request the amendment or the repeal of a rule. We have dash A3 amendments also, which are crafted and designed to relate to individuals who serve on any state board or commission. Aside from the streamlining portions of this measure, people who serve on commissions or in salaried positions may not be employed by the board or commission in a salaried position while serving on a board or within 1 year after the person's normal term has expired, regardless of whether the person continues to serve on the board after the expiration of the person's term.
Thank you very much, colleagues. This is another one that has a very enticing relating clause relating to agencies, and it's, in my view, become sort of the government streamlining bill of the session. So I'm awaiting. We will probably adopt some amendments that we have before us today. I'm awaiting another significant amendment that we'll be looking at as well. So with that, let's have Mr. Allen, Patrick Allen, come up, and Tom Gallagher. Oh, forget Tom Gallagher. Let's just have him. Oh, sorry. We have an Irish overload quota here, and Mr. Gallagher, and you're dangerously close to violating it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just read in the paper that they have now determined that the chimpanzee is closely related to the human being, and it's my fear that the direct relationship occurred through the Irish, and so you and I both should check our ancestry.
Yeah, well, the other thing they've done is they're curtailing advertisement of alcohol in Ireland, which, you know, means that it is a new day, and the chimps won. So go ahead, please. Mr. Allen, would you like to start?
After that, no.
I would think that the advertisement of alcohol in Ireland was a redundancy anyway. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is...
And you are?
I am Tom Gallagher, representing Snitzer Industries here. Thank you. This bill is a bill that John Chandler and I have been working on all through the summer and into this year. And when the session started, we sat down with the agencies and with DCBS and with the governor's office and other folks and crafted the amendments, the A-A bill that you have before you. It is going to be the starting point, really, for the changes in agency streamlining and agency rulemaking. The advisory committee that will work with DCBS will really be working on Section 183 of the statute and putting together a framework for how we begin to do the hard work of really streamlining agency rules, and the rules work will lead into the permitting process for state agencies. One of the things that I would point out to you, and Mr. Allen will go through the bill in its sections, are the pieces of Section 183 where lobby groups have come in front of this body and tried to do something about rulemaking and have failed. It just hasn't had any impact. In Section 332 of 183, we tried to limit Oregon rules by applying a federal stringency standard. In 0.530, we put in housing impact costs. In 0.540 We put in economic impacts on small business. There's another provision in here, 362, which talks about biennial review of rules to eliminate surplus rules. All of the little fixes we've done have not changed the rulemaking process. And what the governor has done in his executive order and what DCBS and through the role of Mr. Allen and the policy review have set out to do is to begin a systematic study of agency rules to avoid duplication, to take agency rules like water permits that are covered in three or four different agencies, find ways of drafting those rules so that there's a single permit process, a single set of information, and it's going to take us a couple of years to begin to set up this framework. You will see the fruits of this legislation coming back, I think, in the 2005 when this committee will make a report to the legislature about statutory changes or directions or rewrites in 183 to make these changes possible. I'd use the analogy here of 3557, which we passed last year, about studying industrial lands, which ended up being coming Senate Bill 467 and on industrial lands and has a large piece of it inside of the transportation package bill of this session. It's going to take a lot of hard work, and it's going to take a lot of talented people on this advisory committee who will spend some time rethinking the way that government works and the way it works through its rules and through its permitting process. So I think we'll let Mr. Allen go through the bill, and then we'll be available to answer any detailed questions. I would commend to you, though, that the A4 amendments, which are again, are pieces of this process already starting, which they're two simple pieces that change the agency. When you petition an agency for rulemaking, they get 90 days because there's going to be an increased criteria for what it takes to get a rule passed. And in the other section, because we move parts of 183 around, the second part of the A4 amendments changes the criteria only to amendments or repeals of rules for this two-year interim period until the committee gets done with its work. So they're just housekeeping. Although they're four pages long, they're very minor.
And Mr. Gallagher, before you start, Mr. Allen, have you seen and are you okay with the -3 amendments?
The -3 amendments are fine.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of Mr. Gallagher? Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, and I hesitate to observe that I'm Irish on my mother's side, but that may not be relevant to the actual bill in front of you.
Well, you can tell her that Mr. Gallagher insulted her today during testimony, but other than that, you're fine.
You've heard a summary of the bill already, so I'm not going to go into great detail about what this bill covers, but I will just give you sort of what we perceive to be the important highlights of what we think it'll accomplish. It establishes an advisory committee, which, as you heard, is going to focus on the administrative rule writing process. In particular, the language at the top of page 2 of the A engrossed House bill points this advisory committee to the pieces of ORS 183 that deal with how agencies consider the impacts on business of proposed rules. Agencies today, as Mr. Gallagher observed, are charged with considering those business impacts and dealing with them in a number of ways. Most agencies will readily admit that sometimes they do a good job of assessing those impacts and dealing with them, and sometimes for lack of information, lack of time, lack of ability to engage with large numbers of smaller businesses, a variety of reasons, sometimes that's a fairly challenging task for them. So this advisory committee will look at that process, look at what's required under law, make recommendations to the next legislative assembly, and help assess the effectiveness of agencies complying with what's currently in law. Second, while this task force exists and while it's making its recommendations, parties to administrative rulemaking processes can refer ongoing rulemaking examples or circumstances to the task force, not for the task force to take any action or participate in the rulemaking, but to help illustrate to the task force and shine a light on examples, good or bad, of how that process is working. Most of the rest of the bill, in fact, just makes some minor changes to the existing existing requirements having to do with considering business impacts, more along the lines of either helping draw attention to them in this process or helping refine those requirements and providing agencies a little bit more guidance on the types of things that they need to consider or how they need to make those considerations to make that process of how business is impacted and how those impacts are dealt with a little bit clearer for agencies. Finally, just to be a little clearer on the Dash 4 amendments, part of the bill repeals the requirement for triennial review. Right now, every agency, every 3 years, goes through an exercise of reviewing every rule on the books for a variety of criteria. The proposers of the bill have suggested eliminating that, but moving significant pieces of it into the portion of the statute that deals with petitions to amend or repeal rules. And as Mr. Gallagher stated, right now on those petitions, agencies have to respond within 30 days. Agencies or the commissions that control their rules have to respond within 30 days. What we've done is we've, in this bill, increased the factors that they need to consider to include business impacts and the requirement that they take public testimony. And so we need to lengthen that time frame to allow for that added consideration and that added testimony. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, I hope when this committee's up and running that in addition to looking at the business aspects of streamlining, that they look at their relationship with local governments as well. I mean, I just had an example of Bonita where they did the train overpass, and ODOT signed off, took a long time, it was a very complex deal. ODOT signs off, they get ready to construct the bridge, and it's either DEQ or Division of State Lands comes in, creates a horrible problem for them, which almost affected their funding and just left the mayor or the city manager tearing his hair out. So I think it's a great thing you're doing, and I'm glad you worked on it over the interim. Any questions, colleagues? Mr. Perry, you want to come up and give us your pitch?
Thank you, Chairman Corcoran, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Restaurant Association. I'm here to address the Dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3120. This is to address a concern, problem, however you want to say it, that we have discovered in the interim or late interim, early parts of session, and obviously with a turnover in administrations, there are director positions that have come up, and for whatever reasons, some different agency boards and commissions that haven't been reappointed that have basically been sitting there, obviously because of special sessions or because they want to save them for the next governor. But as some of these agency director positions came open, we started looking at some of the people that were on the existing commissions to potentially try to get some consistency through the process. And I think to a surprise to many of us, there was this law on the books that we're addressing in this statute. And what we're trying to do with the amendment, instead of completely doing away with what the law says currently, is if you serve on a board or commission, you can't serve for a year or take a paid position for a year after your term expires. What has happened in a couple of situations is these people haven't been reappointed. Their term's over, but they're still serving. So there was a legal question whether or not they were eligible. So what we're trying to do is just address that legal question. As we're still saying it has to be a year from when your term was over, but if you're still serving, it shouldn't hamper you from being considered in this position. I would say that the governor still has to allow them to serve because they serve at the pleasure of the governor. He can cancel at any time, and you would still have to be selected as a potential candidate. So there are still certain safeguards that are going to be in place, and we think that the intent of a year after the term is over is still met. So with that, I'd offer up the A3 amendments and be open for any questions.
Well, Mr. Perry, I understand you became a legal researcher in the middle of doing this. Could you just give us a little more of a flavor of what particular issue you were trying to resolve?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are certain specific agencies that came open that we were concerned about. Health and Human Services, because they do our food inspections, lottery, and OLCC. And obviously a lot of these, there are people with knowledge on the commissions that have dealt with the industry, have dealt with the governor's office, have a lot of expertise and experience, and we think that gives them certain qualities that make them attractive, obviously, to different parties. And so they were being considered at the time. Whether or not they would have got the job is a different question, but we found out they couldn't even be considered. So really, from a business standpoint, having somebody with some consistent knowledge on how the agency works and the issues, I think, is attractive. And so to say they absolutely can't be considered, we're just trying to address that part of it. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Any questions?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Perry, I want to thank you for doing the legal research that I asked you.
It was my pleasure.
You are such a liar.
They've got very nice carpet over there, if we don't remember that story from a few years ago.
Yeah. His eyes got big and wide when I said, well, why was the law passed in the first instance? Well, I don't know. Well, I'm going to ask you that question in committee, so you need to find me the answer. And I just think it's absolutely fascinating to use the library and use the resources of Dave Harrell upstairs, because he's just such a wealth of information. And this law, as you so aptly found out for us, was first passed in 1953. But unfortunately, back in 1953, they don't keep the kind of records that they do today. So we really have no legislative history. We have a lot of... this was so fascinating. It says a bill, and then someone crossed it out and wrote an act and sort of amended it right then and there. But we have no legislative history as to why this was put in place. And I was thinking about it all last night after you and I talked. And I reviewed the amendment again, and I think I'm going to be okay with it, because you're still going to maintain that separation. Because I think it's really important, and I think you might agree with this, that the people who serve on the commissions sort of advise and watch over the agency also. So you don't want someone who's serving in a volunteer capacity on a commission with their eye on a larger prize to suddenly be elevated to be the director or in some other salaried position. Wouldn't you agree that's sort of the concept here?
Yes, Senator Walker, Chairman Corcoran. And like I said in my testimony, we didn't want to remove the statute altogether. And working with the governor's offices and other, obviously by the research, we don't absolutely know what the intent was, but from my perspective and when we were working with the governor's office, is trying to keep the intent of, make sure their term was over for a year. Some of the people when we talked in past had said, well, if they're doing a favor for the state because they can't find a replacement for the board or commission and still want to serve for a year afterwards, at that point, in my opinion, they're doing a service for the state or the governor or whoever, and it doesn't mean they should be automatically disqualified. And so we try to keep the part in there that says it has to be a year after your term's been over, and that way if there is any problems or whatever, the governor can get rid of them, because they do serve at the pleasure of the governor for almost all of these boards and commissions. So we try to leave intact what I think the core policy is, would be my argument.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair. When you brought this issue to my attention, too, I thought back to the 99 session when I served on the Legislative Council Committee. And the governor had appointed Michael Powell to serve on the Pork Commission. His term expired. He reappointed him, but the legislature, the Senate, wouldn't confirm. So the governor left him there in place to continue serving, and it became a big legal dispute. And I actually don't know how that was ever resolved, though the committee authorized going to court over the darn thing. But, I mean, in that situation, his term had expired.
Mm-hmm.
He's still serving. What if he would have been up for a position, a salaried position, under this law as it exists today? He couldn't do that because he's still serving. But under the change that you want to make, his appointment ran out and he was just sitting there doing his job, but he is not officially appointed.
If this law were intact and he served a year after the term was up. But once again, I mean, you would have to be appointed. You still have to get the job. It doesn't guarantee you the job, so that is true. And to your earlier question, I mean, as they serve at the pleasure of the governor, so they can be released from the governor. But the way boards and commission laws say in the Constitution is you do serve until your appointment is confirmed. And so that's why he existed on that board, even though he wasn't approved by the governor. But he could have been fired at any point by the governor, because they do serve at the pleasure.
Right. They were involved in a little boys' match of whatever. Anyway, okay, well, I absolutely do appreciate the research. I'm just a fanatic about that kind of thing, and... Well, it didn't show me much.
I've always considered myself quite a scholar. So.
I think it's important that we know how people were thinking when they passed these laws in the first instance before we go changing them.
Fanatic's just the long term of fan, I presume, Senator Walker. For the record, Mr. Perry did produce minutes of a meeting from March 11, 1953, held in room 300 with Senators Ellis, Hardy, Brown, Neuberger, Gibson, Hounsell, and Giersbeck. Senator Brown is very old. Thank you very much.
Is that it?
Any other questions, Mr. Perry? Seeing none. Colleagues, I'd like to adapt the -3 and -4 amendments and then hang on to this bill until some other amendments come in.
Are we in work session?
Yes, sir.
Chair, move -3 and -4 amendments.
Senator Menace moves the -3 and -4 amendments to House Bill 3120. Any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Menace?
You want to move the bill or hold it?
Oh, never mind.
No.
Close work session. Thank you. Okay. That's twice I've done that. It's hard to get good help. It's the chimpanzee thing. All right, we will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3422. Would you tell us what that does, Mark?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 3422A, as brought to the committee, requires all bids made public, requires all bids made to public contracting agencies to be opened publicly by the public contracting agency immediately after the deadline for submission of the bids. It requires bidders to disclose first-tier subcontractors within 2 hours after a deadline when bids are due. It requires a deadline for submission of bids to have a due date and a time that is Tuesday through Friday between 2 p.m. and 5 p.m. It clarifies provisions of this measure apply to non-highway projects. It specifies that these bidding provisions apply to public improvement contracts valued at more than $100,000 and requires the disclosure of first-tier subcontractors to include their name, type of work that they perform, and the dollar value of each subcontract. It provides a form for the disclosure of first-tier subcontractors. It declares an emergency and is effective on August 1, 2003. The committee has been given an amendment which clarifies that the amendments to the statute as set forth in this measure apply to public improvement contracts first advertised on or after the effective date of the act, giving some clarification. We've also been passed another amendment, which I know nothing of.
Who are the authors of the 8-5 amendments, please? Or who is the author of the 8-5? Is that Ms. Dilks? Okay. And who is the author of the 8-4 amendments?
Mr. Chair,
that
came from the city of Eugene,
through
the chair.
Okay. All right. 8-4 is Eugene. Okay. Let's have Jessica Harris and Angie Dilks come up, please. And then after that, we'll have Linda Ludwig and John Oshel from the cities and counties.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in support of House Bill 3422. This issue, for subcontractor disclosure, has been a source of controversy and significant negotiation between labor, subcontractors, and general contractors over the last three sessions. This concept was first adopted in 1999 in a flurry of extreme discontent at AGC's part, and we finally came to an agreement last session about some things after approximately 15 weeks of discord. This bill we brought together as an industry. So this is a pretty momentous occasion for us to together as an industry agree to these changes that are important for this law, are important for the construction community, to make this law really work for all of us in a way that is beneficial. What this bill does is it drops for public improvement contracts when you're bidding, say, a school, when your bid is due, within 2 hours after the time that a general contractor has submitted his or her bid, list the first-tier subcontractor disclosures that you plan on contracting with, who the general contractor will have a direct contract with, if those contracts with those folks are anticipated to be greater than 5% of the bid, or for a really large contract above $350,000. This bill drops what was 4 hours to 2 hours, requires immediate opening of the bids because there often, more often than not, are many, many bids that are bidding on one day. And if you are bidding on five or six bids, which right now in this environment, if you're a construction contractor of any size, you are, because bid lists are looking at 11 and 12 bidders on any particular bid at this point. If you come in eighth on the bid, you aren't going to get it. And it doesn't matter what happens the first or the second. Chances are, if you're eight down in terms of price, you aren't going to get that job. So what we're asking for is when the bids are due, open them. So if we know that we're second, that we do a good job of submitting a list of who we're going to use. But if we're 10th, and we have two bids in that day, but it doesn't make sense for us to go through the process if we're 10th. That's just not a useful thing for contractors' time. It's not useful to public agency either. This is, by the way, a process that ODOT does currently and works well for them. We have also set a time on Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursdays between 2 and 5 p.m. for building contracts. This section does not apply to highway contracts, but for building contracts to be submitted and open. This will return the law to the way it was prior to, or the industry practice the way it was prior to the passage of subcontractor disclosure law in 1999. This was generally industry practice and generally how public agencies operated, and this will encourage returnment to that same kind of procedure. Finally, this also includes form. Right now, we see different kinds of forms all across different agencies, and some forms that not only require the information that was set out in statute, but also require a listing of things like who your bonding agent is and what your CCB license number is, and just a whole variety of things. If you miss any one of those, you're a non-participant, which means the agency can't award to you. So public agencies who find a bidder who's low, who miss one line on their subcontractor disclosure form, that's thrown out. And that's not in the agency's interest. That's not in the contractor's interest. So we've created a form that will ensure consistency for the construction community, but also make sure that we don't end up with forms that disqualify contractors because of superfluous information that isn't intended to be collected at the time of disclosure. So this is an important bill. We do strongly ask the committee to adopt the A5 amendment, which simply clarifies that bids advertised on or after this effective date become applicable to this law. this is pretty standard language that generally comes in public contracting bills, because if you just make it effective and you enter a contract for which you didn't advertise as supplied, you already bid it, that contract is subject to significant challenge because the contractor would be non-responsive for having not done this in advance. So that's why this amendment is necessary.
Jessica, give me an example of what you're trying to cure here.
The concern on the subcontractor side has been that the amount of time allowed for disclosure is too wide, and they're concerned about any activity that occurs in that four-hour window, and so the compromise was to go to 2 hours. The issue with opening at bid time is, again, about useful and efficient use of resources, both on the agency time and, more importantly, on the contractor time, if they're bidding on multiple bids on the same day. Returning the bid days and the bid times to what industry practice was prior to the issuance of this law is an effort on the construction community to get back to how they did business before, which produced a better result. The building community, as a general rule, has in the past done daytime bidding. Highway contractors choose to stay up all night. That's how they do the work. Building contractors have generally done business during the day, and switching to the morning bid time has changed the way that industry works, and it has been not a positive result and hasn't produced the kind of environment that was as conducive to business dealings and the best value for the agency as it was prior to the issuance of this law. So we feel that moving to this time is going to better allow for good prices to the public. Overall, this is a good set of changes that really help the industry work with this law and present a good compromise on this really contentious issue.
Why was the law changed in 99?
It was changed at the subcontractors and building trades request because there was concern about an industry practice called bid shopping. There is significant debate and not necessarily concurrence, and certainly not concurrence on the HC side, that this law necessarily fixes that problem. However, what it does fix is the subcontractor's desire to know fairly up front who's going to have the work, instead of having to wait a few months to kind of sort that out through a contract arrangement.
And how does AGC feel about the Dash 4 amendments?
We are opposed to the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay. Any questions of Jessica? Angie, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Angie Dilks, and I am here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association, the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. I need to shorten their names a little for me, but I would agree with Jessica's assessment of the process. This engrossed version of the bill is the result of a compromise, and I think the fact that we're sitting next to each other testifying in support of the bill says a lot about the folks that are behind this bill, because we don't normally agree on a lot of things. So our folks are very supportive of this bill and agree with the need for the Dash 5 amendment.
Now, if we could only get you together on 3010, huh? I'd like to know how you feel about the A4 amendments.
We just looked at them, but we would not support them.
Okay. Any other questions of these two? All right. Thank you very much.
No.
Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a question in jest. As I was reading this, it requires a deadline for submission of bids, have a date and time that is Tuesday through Friday between 2 p.m. and 5 p.m. I was thinking, and so the vernal equinox before Easter, after God, after this. I mean, I never know when Easter is because it's very weird the way it's calculated. And this sort of reminded me of that you're specifying a date and a time. I think, Jessica, you explained the need for that because of the workers who work by day and the workers who work by night and so on and so forth.
Yes, Senator Walker, this is a construction industry, especially on the building side. A practice that they are used to and something they do on the private side, and it makes it'll make for a better result for public agencies, which fixes a problem.
So the private sector uses this kind of timeline as well?
Well, the private sector doesn't have specific timelines, but as a general rule, submission happens later in the day because the building industry generally is a late-in-the-day kind of... They like working during the day, late into the day, into the evening. Highway contractors like working.
Right.
It's just bless them, that's what they like to do.
Well, I think it's mostly because people are traveling the roads during the day and they've got to work at night in order to keep us happy. But anyway, I appreciate your hard work. I've been here since 99 and been involved in these heated discussions that you've had in front of my committees, and it's so nice to see you sitting next to each other, very next to each other, with smiles. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's have Linda Ludwig and John Oshel from Association of Oregon Counties. Linda from League of Cities.
Chairman Cochran, members of the committee, I'm John Oshel, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. Don't come to you necessarily in opposition, but so much to say, hey, there's some other issues out there. The bid shopping issue has been highly contentious, and we obviously would like to see that resolved. But they negotiated this whole thing out and came up with a compromise without talking to the folks that have to award the contracts, and there are some negative impacts of the proposed solution. What I'd ask you to do is consider whether the negative impacts to us are worthy enough to come up with a solution to the bid shopping. We haven't been a part of that major debate. You guys have listened to it, so I figure you're probably in a better place to make that judgment call. But I thought it was appropriate to let you know what the issues were. The first one, of course, has to do with the issue about opening immediately after deadline of submission for bids. And at this point, I'm talking primarily smaller local agencies. You know, the big agencies got one system that's set up where basically this is all done by staff. When you get local agencies, most of the stuff is done before the governing body of the agency. And we've always liked to do that, because it formalizes the process, makes everybody sort of stand up and say, hey, this is important, we got to get it right. We try and make it as formal as we can, so we do it in front of them. Traditionally, before these four-hour delay rules came along, there was always a short delay for the very simple reason that in a small agency, the secretary that was receiving all the bids was the same secretary that then had to turn around and take notes at the meeting. So there was always a 10 or 15-minute delay, usually between when you accepted bids and when you opened them. Typically, you open them up early in the meeting, and then staff would run off in the back of the room or down the hall and check the bids and check the bonds and a few other things you got to check, and everything was ordered. You'd, in many cases, award that contract at that very same meeting that you opened the bids. When we shifted to the four-hour delay to have the first tier, that delay was actually recommended by the Attorney General through his model rules. And what he was trying to solve was the issue that the way it sets up is if you open up the bids and then give them 4 hours to turn it in, and then if you basically look at what we have to do if someone doesn't turn it in, and on your bill it's page 3, lines 19 through 22, if someone doesn't turn that in, basically, what we have to do is say that it is a non-responsive bid and not award. So, in effect, what the contractor does is he opens up the bids and he potentially could say, hey, I left too much money on the table. I don't want the project. All he has to do is not turn in the bid, not turn in the first tier disclosure form. He walks. No bid bond. Penalty, anything. He's free and clear because he didn't accept the contract. We were never allowed to offer it to him. So that was the reason for the recommended of the delay. Now, historically, as far as I know, there really hasn't been problems with the agency that chose not to do the delay, but the potential's out there. I'm wondering if the other solution might be to take this paragraph and say, hey, not only is the thing non-responsive, but if they don't turn it in, and maybe part of that bid bond ought to be forfeit if it's just a case of a guy deciding he doesn't want it and therefore not turning in the forms. Basically, the concept of allowing a guy to just walk sort of bothers us. That makes it so the guy is not really being that serious on what he did. So that's our concern on the immediate. The second area of concern has to do with the hours of opening. And once again, this all floats down to the concept we like to do it, many agencies like to do it, during the time than they're, when the boards meet. In counties, great many of the boards meet in the mornings. Cities, a lot of the special districts, they hold their meetings at night. With the existing language, they were allowed to do that. Basically, with this language, either A, we're going to have to start telling all our boards when to change the times to meet, change the meeting in the afternoons instead of the mornings, or we're basically going to have to start opening these things up just with staff. I'll leave it to you as to whether that is enough of a problem for what we have to rearrange what we do versus what the bidding contractors have to rearrange what they do. We all like to be set in our ways. We understand that. But it's we'll leave it to you how to decide who probably needs to change how they're doing business. So I thank you. Any questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Rochelle, some of these contractors that bid are women, are they not?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to point out to you that you kept referring to a guy.
My sincere apologies.
And it's just not you, but I just wanted to point that out, that there are women in the contracting business.
Chair Cochran, Senator Walker, my sincere apologies. It's old habits that are terribly hard
they're
to break,
hard to
but
break.
You are absolutely correct. It is something I need to improve.
Thank you.
Mr. Rochelle, have you had, or I guess I would ask the same question, Ms. Ludwig, with the Leaf Cities. Have you folks had any discussion with AGC or the construction trades folks or the bidders on this particular bill?
Chairman Cochran, our conversations were after the A engrossed was adopted. We were not aware that these amendments were happening until after they got adopted. The original bill, as you recall, just had a change from 4 hours to 2 hours. That's all we were aware of until after they got adopted by committee.
Okay. Go ahead and start.
Thank you, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig representing the League of Oregon Cities. I would like to concur with Mr. Oshel's remarks and would very much like to ask the committee to consider the -4 amendments. The two issues that we have with the bill, otherwise we would be very supportive of that, of the bill, with including the A5 amendments, are the piece about opening the bids immediately after the deadline, as well as the change of hours. You did hear that there was an industry practice for opening bids in the afternoon. I disagree with that on the private sector, on the public sector portion of industry, and how we've handled those bills, these bids in the past. We have had the ability to, at least under current practice, open them at a much larger margin range of time, and this gives us a total of 9 hours a week, which is extremely limited. I would like to add to Mr. Oshel's comments about the impacts on small jurisdictions and remind you that of Oregon's 240 cities, two-thirds of those are under the population of 5,000. Again, the limitation in opening bids is a large concern to those small cities. I'd like to bring to you that special districts share the concerns that cities and counties do with this bill and support the A4 amendments. And I believe you have a letter from the City of Eugene concurring with the A4 amendments as well.
I guess the problem I have with, you know, usually I would try to acknowledge the concerns that local governments would have about these kind of things, but it doesn't seem like either one of you are able to address the issue of the benefits of prohibiting the bid shopping.
Mr. Chair, no, actually in the 99 session, we were very much involved in the negotiations and in this legislation to prevent the bid shopping piece and have very much supported the disclosure piece. In the original bill that passed that was introduced in the House, we were actually supportive of the bill because it made the disclosure requirement immediately due at the time of the submission of bids. We don't have issue with changing it from 4 hours to 2 hours or immediately for the disclosure form. And frankly, we don't have any issues with having a standardized disclosure form whatsoever. And the amount of information that needs to be there. Our concerns is, again, the time limitation for opening the bills and that it probably just won't work nearly as well in most of our jurisdictions, our cities anyway, to have to open those bids immediately upon submission. As you heard from Mr. Oshel, a lot of our cities, most of our cities, like to do that in a public process where it's open and people can see how that has happened.
Chairman Cochran, members of the committee, once again, don't have any problem at all with having it open immediately after. The problem is the situation where someone could basically walk. My suggestion would be, is there something that we could do to make sure that there is some penalty if someone is just arbitrarily deciding they don't want the project and accomplishing that goal by not turning in the forms? If that problem solved, then the time frame would work fine for us. The issue on the times of opening, I'm not sure that that was clearly identified to me how that helps the bid shopping problem. That seemed more of a convenience for the bidders, which has certain merit to it, but our concern is whether it's worthy of the inconvenience of the governing bodies.
Okay, any other questions? I think you'll probably have to make that argument with the House. If this moves to a conference committee, if they non-concur with the changes that we'll make. So I think that's where we are. With that, we're in work session. Senator Menace.
We have amendments, right?
Yes, sir, the A5s.
A5s, move the A5 amendments.
Senator Menace moves the A5 amendments to 3422. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
3422, right?
Pardon me?
3422. I thought you said 3522.
Oh, excuse me.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Walker.
Ms. Ludwig made reference to a letter from the city of Eugene,
mm-hmm.
and I don't have such a letter in my file.
I can show you mine. Right here. I was just looking at it, so I know I have it.
This letter just restates Ms. Ludwig's position, so thank you for allowing me to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Senator Menace.
Move House Bill 3422 to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Senator Menace moves House Bill 3422 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none. Ms. Gravel, would you call the roll?
Senator Stein?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Chair
Corcoran? Aye. 3422 moves to the floor as amended. Any volunteers for Carrier?
Okay.
Okay, Senator Menace for Carrier. Senator Menace, you're probably pretty busy with your other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll carry it. Thank you. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3422. Thank you very much. And we will open a... I have a work session for reconsideration of House Bill 3061A. Colleagues, we have not lost possession of this bill yet, and I would like to bring it back into committee.
3061A.
And maybe until such time as Mr. Chandler and Senator Schrader can have a little discussion.
Chairman, I would oppose reconsideration.
Okay. Senator Walker, what's your pleasure?
Well, I've only had Mr. Chandler speak to me. I don't know what Senator Schrader's issue is.
Senator Schrader's issue, in a nutshell, is that when he was on a planning commission, a developer in a situation basically agreed to elements of a, in a proposal that he had made, and then reneged on the agreement, and the officer refused to sign the plat, allowing him to do that until such time that the developer was able to correct the errors of his way. And Senator Schrader feels that by opening this up, as this does, that it politicizes the planning process to some degree. So I think he has that's his beef, and that's, Mr. Chandler doesn't agree that is indeed the way to solve the problem. So, we moved the bill out, so it's not a live or die situation in my view. I just was asked to do the reconsideration, and I pose it to you. Where are you, Senator Starr?
Well, this is such a simple bill that, and the bill was scheduled for hearing, and we didn't hear from really anybody that opposed the bill at the time we worked the bill, and we're getting to the point in session that I think it'd probably be good to let the bill move forward.
Close the work session on House Bill 3061A, and we are adjourned. Thank you.